Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to The Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool.
Well, all right. Yes, you are listening to the talk of the town. So, I promised you a little info about aggressive drivers. Really interesting study has been done about this, and it turns out that there's a way to spot an aggressive driver on the highway. Count the number of bumper stickers or decals he has on his bumper or windshield or back of his car, or any kind of a personalization of the car like that. And that is a direct correlation with how likely they are to be an aggressive driver. And I found this fascinating. There's a great column that appears in the Washington Post. I think it's a couple times a week. Maybe it's only once. But it's called The Department of Human Behavior. And it's I think he must be a psychologist. His name is Shankar Vendatam or something like that. And he reports on research findings, mostly psychological research findings. And if the campaign is on, there'll be something about how people perceive candidates or ads or something. Well, this one is about aggressive driving. And it's interesting because I had a student in my summer class a couple of weeks ago do a speech about road rage because he admitted that he suffers from road rage. But this article was interesting because what it said was that aggressive drivers personalize their vehicles in general. That's the correlation they found. They didn't find, though, that it's associated with the message on your bumper sticker. So if you have bumper stickers, you're just as likely to be an aggressive driver if you have aggressive bumper stickers as if you have peace-loving bumper stickers. So you might have a dove and something that says, visualize world peace, as they say. Or you might have the bumper sticker that says, my kid can beat up your honor student. Doesn't matter. It's the bumper stickers themselves that are correlated with aggressive driving or road rage. And here's their explanation. I find this fascinating. Basically, there's personal space and private space in the world. Our home, our apartment is private space. Our car is private space. And we protect it pretty diligently. That is, if somebody came onto our property, we'd protect ourselves. In a public space, you don't actually own that public space. So if you're walking through downtown or you're walking on the campus of a college or a government building or whatever, through a park, you got to share space. So somebody may get in your space with their Frisbee or something, and you kind of have to accept that. Driving is a combination of the two. The roads are public, but when you're in your car, that's your personal property, and we're insulated by that car. And so we pretty much feel that it's our property, but we're on a public road. So the people who are territorial are the people who mark their territory with bumper stickers and decals. So if you put on a few bumper stickers to express yourself and you have decals with the college where you went or some other decal or a sign in the back that says baby on board that was so popular 20 years ago or so, those situations are correlated with aggressive driving. And the thinking is this, that this is a combination of public space, the road, and private space, your car. And so people who are territorial about their property, about their cars, they let it carry over on the road, and they think first about, hey, this is my car, this is my space, this is my road, as opposed to thinking, gee, we're all on this road together and we have to share it. They think, my car, my road, stay out of my way or don't cut me off or whatever. So I just thought that was fascinating that that is correlated. So next time you see somebody with a lot of bumper stickers, you should assume that they are probably territorial about the space they're sharing with you. And even though they may have a bumper sticker that says, visualize world peace, they still might pull their Luger out of their glove compartment and fire a shot across your bow, or should I say your hood. Let's move on now to some international events, because I find a lot more went on internationally than went on nationally. And the big news of the week, really, in national news was the death of Tim Russert. It happened on Friday, but from Friday on, NBC hasn't covered much else. And even Fox and CNN spent a lot of time on Russert, so there was less in the news. And the other thing is, it's, you know, we're just a week after the nomination was sewn up and the primaries are over. So there's just a little bit of a lull as people prepare for the final push of the Republican-Democratic electoral campaign. So I'm moving on to international news, and a couple of interesting things came up. One of them was, it turns out that the smuggling of atomic secrets was more serious than we thought. Drawings were discovered 2 years ago on computers that were owned by a couple of Swiss businessmen, and they included the details for building a compact nuclear bomb, the kind that could be fitted on a ballistic missile. For example, the kinds of missiles Iran and North Korea want. So the plans have been destroyed, and the Swiss government got together with European intelligence authorities and U.S. intelligence authorities, and they checked it out first to see what was out there, what information was there, and then they destroyed it. The problem is it's digital files on a computer. Well, as you know, digital files can be copied an unlimited number of times, and there's no way to know how many times they've been copied. So we're still tracking this down. That is, our intelligence agencies are still tracking this down, but who knows who got these plans? So this all stems from the AQ Khan smuggling network in Pakistan. If you remember, AQ Khan is heralded as a hero in Pakistan because he's kind of the father of the Pakistan atomic bomb. But he also was selling nuclear secrets and making them available for free in some cases to North Korea, to Libya, and indirectly to Iran and other countries. So basically, he's a one-man proliferation society and should have been locked up. The problem was, when we discovered it, Pakistan circled the wagons and protected him. He's a hero there, so there's no way they were going to arrest him. Before he was charged with anything formally, he was pardoned by Pervez Musharraf, and he's in the clear. And in fact, he's refused to answer questions from the U.S. or from the United Nations, and Pakistan's not making him answer any questions. So a very strange kind of situation, but that's what's gone down. And it turns out the damage that he's done has been more extensive. So that's a bit of a problem. Moving on to another little spot of trouble. Afghanistan, the commander who's leaving there, General Dan McNeil, has been leading the forces there for 16 months. Technically, that's NATO forces, but they're primarily U.S. forces, and he's a U.S. general. And he announced on Friday that we've seen a 50% increase recently in attacks from, I guess you call them terrorist attacks, but basically attacks from the other side. And they're centered in the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And, of course, the Taliban is resurgent, and this article in the Washington Post goes into some detail about just how resurgent they are. And it's trouble. So even though we've increased our troops, and Afghanistan has increased its troops in the area, there's a lot more Taliban there now and a lot more trouble than ever. So I can't help thinking that it's interesting how we did Afghanistan. If you remember, in 2001, after September 11th, even though the country was behind the president and the president would have had the authority to go in with 100,000, 200,000 troops, we looked at the lesson that the Russians faced, which was it's a quagmire and you could get bogged down. And we only sent in very light numbers of troops. We sent in advisors, we sent in special forces, and we helped the Northern Alliance defeat the Taliban in over a period of a couple of months. And our special forces went in and eliminated some of the bad guys. But we basically kept a very light footprint so that we didn't get trapped there. Well, guess what? The NATO forces are now up over, I think, 50,000 there. Is that right? Can it be that many? Yeah, I think it is. And we are now trapped there. So I don't know for sure it would have turned out different. But you do have to wonder if instead of being timid and going in with a very light force into Afghanistan, we'd gone in with overwhelming power and laid waste to the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and anybody we'd get our hands on among the bad guys. You do wonder whether, A, we'd have done a better job of defeating those enemies, and B, the world would have looked at it and said, you know, you really don't want to mess with the United States. They come after you with a vengeance. So just food for thought, but we are going to be in Afghanistan a long while. And, you know, nobody talks nation building there. I mean, they do a little bit, but it's a pretty primitive tribal culture. Now, that hasn't stopped the president from trying to promote democracy there and in other tribal cultures, which are totally unsuited for democracy at this stage of their development. And the president just needs to read about spiral dynamics, and he'd have his answer. But beyond that, it's just untamed wilderness. There's simply no way that we are going to tame Afghanistan anytime soon. So we're going to be there a while. So is the Taliban. So is Al-Qaeda. Moving on, it turns out that there are a number of Iraqi leaders who are on the same page as Barack Obama when it comes to troops in Iraq. There's two things going on. One is that a variety of Iraqi leaders are pushing to get the U.S. to start pulling its troops out. The second thing is that there are Iraqi leaders rejecting the U.S. terms for the pact that the U.S. wants Iraq to sign. The mandate that we are there under, which was we went in as an invading country. Within a couple of years, we had a mandate from the UN to rebuild Iraq or stabilize it or whatever. And so technically, we have the okie dokie to be there. But it expires December 31st. And the president and his administration is trying to renegotiate terms or negotiate terms by which we would stay in Iraq. And the Iraqis are balking. And while these negotiations have been secret, the Iraqis are not against going public with this whole issue. So they are saying, hey, we are not willing to let you have 60 bases here permanently. Hey, we are not willing to let you keep over 100,000 troops here. You're going to have to get out. Well, that's a little embarrassing at this point for the Bush administration because they're trying to work out a deal and they don't want it public. Meanwhile, Congress is saying, the Democrats in Congress and some Republicans are saying, look, you can't commit us to long-term security guarantees in Iraq without getting this treaty ratified by the U.S. Senate. And the president and Cheney and the administration saying, no, we're not doing anything permanent here. We aren't tying the hands of the next president. But in fact, you got to suspect they are. So right now, that's going to be a tough one for Bush and McCain to explain when you consider that it turns out the Iraqis, in some of them, want us out. That's a tough one. And we're going to deal with a few other issues in the Middle East and with Iraq when we come back.